Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast. This week, we are interviewing a friend of the Mr. Beacon podcast, Dominic Gunnard, and we're talking to him about the phenomenon of digital product passports, DPP. It's a concept. It's the subject of some legislative drivers. It's closely associated with the idea of having serialization platforms, visibility into the provenance of a product. There's a ton of use cases that are really disruptive that all relate to DPP. And it's a buzzword that's being used in all sorts of conferences about IoT. So Dominic is the VP of innovation at a company called Digimarc. We've featured them, and there's an episode where we describe their digital watermarking technology, really amazing, invisible digital watermarks. Dominic was one of the founders of a company called Everything. He's been on the podcast 3 times before. He's very active on in the GS1 standards community, and the past episodes are great introductions to the concept of digital link, the EPCIS 2.0 standard, which is a way of exchanging metadata that relates to products and sensing events. It's a subject in its own right. And then the very first time I met with Dominic was actually in London, and I interviewed him about this book, which I highly recommend. It's practical, it's hands-on, it's all about how to use Raspberry Pi and getting your hands dirty with web services and the Internet of Things. So enjoy the interview.
The Mr. Beacon Ambient IoT podcast is sponsored by Wiliot, bringing intelligence to every single thing.
So, Dominic, welcome back to the Mr. Beacon podcast. This is the 4th time you've been on. You are a tremendous subject matter expert on many things, but and in the past we've talked about digital link and EPCIS and your book, but this time it's to talk about DPP, digital product passports, and I want to tap into your massive brain and get the lowdown on what, why, and how of DPP. And maybe we should just start off with a quick overview of what is a digital product passport.
So what exactly digital product passport is going to be is still being defined, and that's very important to say, right? I think everything we'll say during this discussion is subject to changes, because there is no regulation written in stone yet in terms of what's DPP really going to be, but the conversations are really happening now. And generally, DPP came out of the Green Deal framework of the European Commission, which looks at making Europe carbon neutral by 2050. And they're doing this, attacking this in many directions, and I have a lot of respect for that effort, because I think it's a, you know, it's a genuine effort to achieve these goals. And one of the sub packages is to think about a digital product passport for products that are actually entering unsold in the European market. And the idea there is really to give products sustainability credentials that can be used for all kinds of purposes, for consumers to know more about the products and to be able to make a greener choice. Just like we make healthier choices today, we should tomorrow be able to do greener choices. But also for governments to be able to have full audit trails in terms of sustainability, credentials of products, customs. It's really for all kinds of stakeholders.
Yeah, I think it's important for multiple reasons. And later on in this conversation, we'll talk about one of my environmental heroes, Mike Berners-Lee, younger brother of Tim Berners-Lee, who invented HTTP and the Mosaic browser and all that sort of thing. Mike Berners-Lee is a professor of climate science at Lancaster University. And
In the UK?
In the UK. And I was talking to him about, he's written a couple of amazing books. How Bad is a Banana is one of them. Basically, the carbon footprint of everything. It's kind of an encyclopedic almanac type reference book. And it helps you become literate in terms of, we have financial literacy. You kind of know that it's probably not good to buy a lot of champagne unless you have a good income, and maybe you can buy other things that are going to be lower cost. But we tend not to know what the carbon footprint is. Are bananas good or bad? Is kind of one of the central questions. Should you be drying your hands with paper towels or the air dryer? That kind of stuff. And the answer is actually, that's almost irrelevant, because other things are just so massive in terms of so much more impactful. Don't waste your time. Think about your travel, your flights. These are the things that make a difference.
It's like, should I turn off the water while I brush my teeth, right? I mean, this is so besides the point. I mean, I didn't know about him, and I will definitely check him out. My personal source of inspiration is called Project Drawdown. I don't know if you know about this project, but it's basically, I think, 200 scientists that created a foundation that looks into what are the solutions we have today to the climate change problems. And it's basically a very positive book in the sense that it shows we have hundreds of solutions at hand. And it's really data-driven in terms of what's the impact of this and that solution, this and that problem. It's a book you should really check it out.
I will.
And I will check out.
So, to finish off my Mike Berners-Lee story, he believes that empowering consumers with knowledge of the carbon impact of the products they're consuming is one of the most important things we can do. I was pitching to him, Williot, my day job employer, and how we can make things more efficient. And he said, forget about it. There's the rebound effect. As soon as you make it more efficient, it's going to be cheaper, and when it becomes cheaper, people will use more of it. And basically, we've got a terrible record of just consuming more and more as we make things cheaper. But what he's hopeful about is the power of the consumer and their wallet and their purse, and how if you tell them that this banana has got a lower carbon footprint than this one, that these peaches that were kept... It's not just about the travel, it's about how long they've been kept in a cold store. That's one of the biggest things. The out-of-season fruit and vegetables are one of the worst things for the environment, but we don't know. Maybe we have trained ourselves to look to see, well, is this coming from Chile or is it coming from down the road? We don't necessarily think about all the other things. And so we need the data. And so obviously a digital product passport would give people, consumers, the information that they need to vote with their wallets. And then when they vote with their wallets, then the whole supply chain ends up getting reconfigured, and the right incentives drive the right behavior. And then maybe we won't end in a state of oblivion. That's kind of the logic. So I see DPP as being positive from that perspective. How is this different from what your company, everything now Digimarc, have been doing for years? It seems like you have been assembling the metadata for digital product passports for a long time. What's new?
Yeah, that's right. And many other companies have. I think what's really different is that it is going to become a regulation. It is going to become the law. And personally, that's a moment I've been waiting for almost forever, for my entire career, right? This turnkey moment where digital product identities are no longer something that's nice to have, but are a must. And here, a must for a pretty good cause. So I'm really thrilled about the potential of this regulation. It's going to be hard. Companies will like it at times, will hate it at times. But I think ultimately, it really has the potential to change things fundamentally, to your point before, right? Starting with consumer information, but also going way above and beyond that, B2B as well, so that companies can understand the footprint of working with company X or Y in a much better way. Today, all of this information is completely invisible. To your point about fruits, we just don't know. We just don't realize the impact of a particular fruit versus another. It's immensely complex. So it's all about surfacing this data.
And I think, whenever you start thinking about how you work towards this ideal of informing consumers about the carbon footprint, you suddenly realize how complicated it is. There's this thing called scope 1, scope 2, scope 3 emissions, which we've talked about in other episodes. But basically, the scope 3 includes all of the suppliers that are feeding into, say, a retailer. And so you may know the amount of the emissions that your company is incurring from the fuel consumption and the transport, but you need to know all of the elements down the supply chain. And it seems like with the DPP, you have a much easier way of rolling up those numbers to give you something that is meaningful and accurate.
Indeed, yeah. And I think one thing that I'm hopeful that DPP will enforce is or will facilitate is interoperability and basically sharing of this data, because it's a multi-stakeholder problem that requires data exchanges in the world of supply chains where today so little data is being exchanged. I think it's just one important aspect about DPP. It's not only about carbon footprint. It's also about other ways to improve the environmental footprint of products by, for instance, there's a strong emphasis on reuse, recyclability, on being able to replace parts of products. DPP should cover also electronic products where there'll be a mandate for electronic product suppliers to basically offer ways of repairing products and changing spare parts. I think that's also a very good step.
And what is the state of the legislation? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a bit hard to give a definitive answer. I'm, first of all, not affiliated with the European Commission, so I don't have the exact data. But there is a core regulation called the ESPR, and that core regulation is pretty much finalized and being discussed by the different member states and should be signed pretty quickly. I'd say within 2024, we'll see that core regulation sign. Now, that core regulation, again, the ESPR, is basically the common factor across the board of all verticals that DPP will impact. It doesn't say, for instance, if you are an apparel company, here's what you have to do, here's the data you have to provide, here's the identifier you need to have on your shirt. But it says everything that's common across all industries. And then there'll be delegated acts on a per vertical basis that will be written in the next few years that will really say, okay, well, specifically for apparel, this is the kind of things you'll have to think about. For other sectors, there'll be another delegated act. Transversal to this, there are also a few other regulations that are now being modified to refer to DPP. So that's, for instance, the case of the construction product regulation, which is already in force to basically allow more circularity and more recyclability in the construction product industry. Now, this regulation is being modified. There's a draft that's actually referring back to DPP. So there will be a lot of other regulations that will now refer back to DPP. And so for these transversal regulations, it might go a bit faster because the regulations are already in place. It's just a modification.
And I'd heard with car batteries, that was one of the aspects that's moving faster.
Yeah, that's one of the first ones. Again, here there are also additional regulations that are referring to DPP, so pretty similar to construction product regulation. So yeah, these are some of the sectors where it's going to go the fastest.
So is there anywhere that people can go to get a sense of what the data elements are going to be that need to be maintained as part of a digital product passport?
Yeah, there are a few sources. I mean, there's the European Commission had a great idea, which is to basically also launch a kind of project, a side project with different partners, which only goal is to promote what DPP will be like and to incubate what DPP will be like. That project is called CIRPAS, with several partners across Europe. And so that's a great source in terms of finding the data about what DPP is shaping up to be like. In terms of the data formats, that's not defined yet. That's going to be defined in the delegated acts. And there are several working groups that are working on this. With Digimarc, we're part of the GS1 circularity mission-specific work group that's looking at how can GS1 standards contribute to the DPP. That's not the only one, but it's an interesting place to start. But again, these data formats is something that's not defined yet.
Yeah, I can imagine GS1 could have a major part to play in that. So I think so. We don't know the exact schema that's going to be put in place, but I don't think that means we have to do nothing, right? It's not like waiting for that. What should companies and professionals be doing to get ready?
Digital identities for products, that's a given, right? That's something that's already in the ASPR, and that's something that you need to have as a brand. You will need it in the future, so you better start thinking about it now. And we see that very much in some of the sectors where we work. Apparel is an example where all brands of a significant size are now seriously thinking about, okay, we need digital identities on our products, ideally serialized, because that's for sure going to be part of the ground layer. Is going to be, you need digital identities and accessible digital identities. I think there the European Commission was pretty wise in already specifying things like these digital identities need to be consumer accessible, need to be easy for consumers to get information from. So I think that's where standards are going to be striving because, that standards obviously allow for easier access and more interoperability.
This is interesting. So this provision about it must be consumer accessible kind of potentially is going to break down some of the walls, the obfuscation, the hiding of data, which, in the past you've gone into a store, and I've told this story many times before, but I go to this organic food store near my house. It's called Jimbo's. And they have these little signs that say this was harvested this date from this farm 34 miles away. And it's like I'm spending a lot more money buying that because it just makes me feel like I trust where it's coming from, and it's probably less likely to kill me. It's going to taste better. And this is from a supply chain that is transparent. It just makes me feel good about the food that I'm consuming.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile.
Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Most consumers, most stores do not expose that information. And I think a lot of the time, the supply chain is filled with actors that really don't want to share that information for maybe legitimate commercial reasons. They don't want to have the retailer doing an end run past them. And do you see this potentially changing that?
Yeah, I mean, and it's a problem I've seen throughout my entire career, sharing data in the supply chain is definitely not a given. And yeah, definitely can change that. I think this is the power of regulations. This is really where regulators can help with problems that just the industry is not going to tackle unless they have to. So I think that's the exciting part of DPP.
So reasons to be happy if you're in Europe. What about the US? Do you think this is just going to be a no-op, or will there be some repercussions in the US?
Yeah, I had a lot of discussions around that with customers and prospective customers who told me, well, I mean, we're in the US, we're a US brand, it doesn't really matter for us. I always point back to the example of GDPR and the fact that at some point, US companies were like, well, GDPR is not affecting us. Well, it is, because you're operating in the European territory and you have European customers. I think exactly the same is going to apply for DPP. Basically, the burden is going to be on the company putting the products on the European territory to provide a DPP. So if you're a US brand and you do not want to address the European market, which I think is a pretty big market, then you could get away without DPP. But as soon as you want to address the European market, you will need to adhere to DPP. And I think ultimately it's going to raise the bar. And I, you know, knowing US brands are always at the forefront of adopting technology, I think ultimately that's going to be a worldwide deployment, or at least US, Europe.
Yeah, and I wonder if markets like California are likely to look at what's happening in Europe and potentially copy it. There's a chance that would be, it's hard to imagine there being US DPP legislation, given that we can't even pass a budget. But I could see California because they certainly responded to GDPR. They've got form, if you like, in terms of that.
In apparel, in fashion, that's an example where the US has also, there are no fashion-related or apparel-related regulations in the US as well that share pretty similar objectives with what the DPP is likely to ask from apparel brands.
So if I'm a product, if I'm a head of innovation, a product strategist, a head of IT in a product company, what are the standards that I should be looking at in order to build an infrastructure that will help support DPP?
So there again, there's nothing written in stone. The ESPR is not mandating a particular standard over another one. And also, I'm, you know, fairly involved with GS1 standards, so I'm probably going to lean towards those. But I think it's a safe bet. Of them are pretty clearly a safe bet. The first one would be GS1 Digital Link, because that gives you a simple, standard way of creating web-accessible identities for your products. You can go SKU level, which would be generic for all products of a particular kind, or you could go batch level, or you could go serialized level. And it's likely that the delegated acts, depending on the vertical, will require different levels of serialization. So that's great. It's web-enabled, so that's fairly accessible. You can have it in a QR code. You can have it in a beacon, in a Bluetooth beacon, or you can have it in a NFC tag. So that's one. At the identity level, I think is a no-brainer.
So you basically have a URL that can be used to retrieve the information that describes the product for all sorts of reasons, but not least of which to look at where the products come from and what's in it and how to recycle it, and all these other things can be in that data structure.
Yeah, and plus you can use it for other things. You can now use it for point of sales systems. Sunrise 2027 is the objective that the industry set itself on to allow the reading of digital links instead of 1D barcodes at POS systems. So this is definitely happening. So I think that's a real opportunity for brands to put in place a system that's not just going to fulfill the regulation, but also make their products future-proof. And so I'm really excited about digital link and its powers.
And of course, we have a whole podcast on that that people can go back and retrieve. But say a little bit more about this Sunrise initiative. Is this a GS1 initiative?
It's a GS1 US initiative primarily, and then GS1 Global did relay it. And I think it was a super nice initiative to basically kind of motivate everyone around the GS1 ecosystem to start embracing the 2D code, because it has so much powers, including for regulatory reasons, but not only. And so they put a call out there for all the actors in the ecosystem to start testing 2D codes, and that is POS vendors, so point of sales vendors, scanner vendors, brands, retailers. Everyone started testing things. And the tests have been pretty conclusive, pretty good. Scanning speed, readability using existing scanners is pretty good. It's primarily a software upgrade. So I think overall the industry is getting ready for it.
Very good.
And of course our phones can read it readily today, right? So that's great.
So getting back to my question about the, you know, how do you get ready and what are the relevant standards? And, you know, very often legislation does not specify a particular standard, but it helps to think about these standards to get ready. So digital link from GS1 makes sense. You need to think about the data carrier that you're going to use. Maybe it's a QR code, NFC, Bluetooth tag, ambient IoT, RFID. These are all different data carriers that can essentially give you the way of accessing that digital link. What about the exchange of data between parties in the supply chain?
Yeah, so there, again, I had the chance to work on another standard called EPCIS, GS1 EPCIS, and we had another podcast about it. And I think that's an interesting one because it's kind of the lingua franca of the supply chain. And I don't think there are many other alternatives. And EPCIS used to be pretty outdated, and we worked on version 2.0 to basically bring it to the web. And it's likely also to be one of the core components of future solutions, because it gives you a way to capture supply chain events, including sensing data, which might be quite interesting for Williot, right? That's part of the upgrade of 2.0. You can also capture sensing data. And it gives you a way to share this data amongst different suppliers and different partners, because it also specifies an API to share the data. So I don't think it's going to be required to use EPCIS, but I think it's the de facto standard for supply chain events, so likely to be used as well.
I mean, could you use EDI?
You could, I suppose. I'm also not a specialist of EDI, but EDI is more about specific transactions, more replacing paper documents rather than full digital traceability.
Yeah. It seems like those schemas are around, you know, advanced shipping notices, and it's not going to be as good a fit for the rich metadata that is already contemplated within EPCIS.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot. Is there anything that we should have talked about to get people ready to, start drilling into this subject?
Well, and maybe if I can go into another standard that I think would be interesting is, I think with digital product passport, there's also a potential to resolve or at least reduce the greenwashing opportunities for brands, or the greenwashing that's being applied by certain brands. And I think one thing that isn't really part of a core part of the discussions right now, but might be in the future, in future versions of the DPP, is about being able to authenticate transactions and the actors who perform transactions. So we've been working on a European research project called Agro to Circular, where it's about recyclability of plastic and food waste in the agricultural sector. And one of the requirements was, can we make certain sustainability claims verifiable? For instance, my product contains X percent of bioplastic. Well, it's easy to make that claim, but unless you can verify it one way or the other, it's not that useful. And so that's where another standard could help, the W3C verifiable credentials, which is essentially a way of creating credentials for people and organizations so that you could sign these claims. So now I'm saying that this product contains bioplastic. Well, I'm using my digital signature, which has been approved by a government, and I'm part of an organization that has been approved to make claims such as this contains bioplastic. And I'm using this to sign my supply chain event that says there is bioplastic in this product. So the verifiability of these claims, I think, will be, as we get more sophisticated, an important aspect.
That would be awesome. I can imagine that there's some real business benefits to having that kind of quality information to back. If you're selling a luxury product or something like that, then having that authentication method to attest to something would be really valuable.
Yep.
Since you've been on the podcast 3 times already, I'm not going to ask you about the music unless you have 3 songs that you want to talk about. Do you want to talk about songs? I have another question.
Let's go for the other question.
The other question is, you mentioned in a very witty way during one of your presentations or panel discussions at this event that we're at, that you were a vegetarian. And I'm like vegetarian curious, I would say. I am definitely cutting down the meat in my diet. If there's an option to not eat meat, then that's what I'm doing. And I'm interested in how that's been for you, how long you've done it, why?
Yeah, it's an old story. Basically, it was 38 years ago when I was 4 years old. I decided that I didn't want animals to be killed to eat them. So I decided to be vegetarian. I don't fully recall it, but my parents do.
Yeah.
And that's since then I've been vegetarian forever.
And how do you find it, like, if you're in Germany or somewhere like that?
It's actually quite easy. I think the country where I had the most challenges was France, probably, because they have a culture of meat that's very, very deep. Otherwise, most countries are very vegetarian friendly, or they have become. It wasn't easy as a child, actually, but nowadays, it's a trend, and the sustainability aspect of being vegetarian beyond animal welfare is a real good reason today. We know the meat industry has such a heavy impact on carbon emissions that it comforted me in being vegetarian.
Yeah, that's definitely been one of the drivers for me as well, and health as well.
Yeah. When I was 18, I didn't want to be vegetarian anymore because I got bullied, and it was a tough time for vegetarians back then. So I went to my doctor and I told him, look, I mean, I don't want to be vegetarian anymore, but I don't know how it works after having been vegetarian for such a long time.
Yeah.
And I did a blood sampling, and he told me, I've never, ever seen a blood like that, so please do not change anything. So
really? Because it was good?
Yeah, it was so good. The cholesterol levels, the good cholesterol was great, the bad cholesterol was in existence.
Yeah, that's definitely one of my drivers. My cholesterol was not good, and so I started biking to work, and the bike was actually inspired by Mike Berners-Lee, who's a climate scientist, and he wrote a couple of great books, and in those books he talks about the fact that taking an electric bike is the best way to travel. It's actually even more eco-efficient than cycling, because when you cycle, you burn the calories, and especially if you have a meat diet, then you end up...
That's a good point. Yeah, I didn't even think about
that. You end up creating more pollution. So
you have an electric bike now?
I have an electric bike, and I started off just cycling in two or three times a week, and then the mental benefits. I was just getting these... I got addicted to the endorphins, and... I was like in a really bad mood when I was taking the car in, and I felt great when I was cycling in, and I was losing the weight, and just a virtuous cycle. So I now, I very rarely take my car in, and so I'm saving money as well. It's great.
Well, good for you. So next time we talk, you're a vegetarian, right?
Yeah. Certainly heading in that direction. Very good. Well, thanks, Dominic. I always enjoy the personal part of our conversations as well as the business side.
Me too.
So that was my interview with Dom. Hope you really enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I always appreciate completer finishers, and I appreciate your sticking with us to the end of the show. That makes you pretty committed, pretty special, and I would ask you as a friend of the show to do what you can to promote it. Simplest thing is to rate it on whatever the platform is that you're using to listen or watch, and tell your friends. If you have any suggestions, any requests, feedback, I'm really open to it. You can reach me at the Mr. Beacon website, and that's it. Until next time, be safe.